The variety and selection of food today is phenomenal. We talk with farmers fairly often on this show, but what happens to their food once it leaves the farm? What about the processing, packaging, marketing? Today we're going to spend time learning about that link in the food chain that largely begins after the crop is harvested or before the animal goes to market. What are the innovations that will make food tastier, safer, more convenient? That's our subject this week on Town Hall Ohio.
This is Town Hall Ohio, home to interesting people, engaging issues, and enlightening stories. Town Hall Ohio is a production of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation, working to forge a partnership between farmers and consumers, and is supported by Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Now, here's Town Hall Ohio host, Joe Corneli.
Farming is big in Ohio, and therefore farm processing, food processing, is big as well. For every Smucker's or General Mills, there's dozens, if not hundreds, of mom-and-pop food companies who've been in business for decades or maybe just getting started. The Center for Innovative Food Technology recently hosted their annual conference for food manufacturers and those others in the food chain. And I spent some time at that meeting. I visited with experts in marketing, food safety, even robotics in the industry. You're going to hear from a few of them today, but first I would like to introduce you to Rebecca Singer. She is the president and CEO of SIFT, which is the Center for Innovative Food Technology.
We do a little bit of everything related to the food industry. So we provide economic development assistance and business kind of direction, and particularly looking at advancing technology. So whether it's what we're growing, how we're processing it, how we're managing our businesses in the food space, how it all comes together, we're involved a little bit in each of those components to some degree. And we hope that just those activities improve our system, improve the quality of the products that we put forth to consumers, and then ultimately continues to make Ohio a vibrant food production state.
So give someone that never really gave a thought to the fact that we have to have technology if we want to have safe, affordable, convenient foods. What are some of the areas where technology is especially important in the whole food chain?
Well, I think a lot of people look at technology and think it's a negative thing. They always this, well, what does that mean you're doing? I want my natural whole foods. I don't want to have anything that's been done to it. And really, when we talk about technology, it's enhancing the way that we're making products. It's enhancing the techniques in which it enables us to lessen the contaminations. It gives us more credibility in what we're putting forth. It's maybe a new technique that improves efficiencies. So all of those things, they help give a quality product, a nutritional product, and hopefully at a price point that everyone can afford.
So you hosted the Food Industry Summit for 2018. What was it all about? What's its purpose?
We've been doing the summit for 8 years, and each year we just try to challenge ourselves to bring forth topics that are relevant and important for the food processing industry. Workforce is a tremendous issue no matter what business you're in, it seems these days. So that was a key to our program, and our theme to today was what's being done proactively in terms of workforce. Food safety is always something that we put an eye toward. So we had a number of discussions around what are we doing, how can we improve food safety. We also had some opportunities to talk about trends. That's always intriguing. People want to know what's the next big thing, whether it's a fad or if it's going to stick around, and what should we be thinking about if we're developing new products. I always find it fascinating because you just never know what's going to come out next. Most of the time, it's probably not something I would have ever dreamed or probably want to really consume, but it's what consumers are saying, or maybe there's a nutritional component. So we always like to just bring those types of things to the table because there's not a lot of other opportunities to kind of touch on all that kind of information in one setting.
Well, I had the chance to interview some of your speakers here, and our listeners will hear some of them, and we talked a lot about food technology and food safety. You mentioned a key issue that's important across, well, I was going to say the entire food chain, but all of manufacturing and industry in Ohio and much of the nation, and that's workforce development. What were some of the kinds of issues that you heard people talking about either today or through the course of everyday business in terms of making sure we've got people who are prepared to take the jobs that are going to be here in 5, 10, or 20 years?
Well, one of the things we've heard over and over and over again is how hard it is to find good quality people. And you hear that no matter what your business is. So it's a overwhelming challenge. Some of the things that we tried to do and we introduced today was really kind of painting a bigger picture of where is Ohio right now in terms of employment? What are we looking at in the future? One of the comments that I don't believe was made earlier today that we heard last week was really that something like 65% of the jobs of the future haven't even been thought about yet. And when I think when we consider that kind of a number, that's crazy. So we're trying to accommodate the needs now, and what we're trying to project what those jobs are going to be like in the future. So those discussions are very critical and important. Our organization heard it so much that we decided to try to pursue a credential. We're trying to get students at a younger age, get high schoolers involved in food, let them know what's out there, let them know the opportunities, let them know that a job in the food industry doesn't necessarily mean flipping burgers at McDonald's, because that's the first thing I think that comes to their mind, and just trying to show that's one stepping stone. You could become a manager at that particular restaurant. You could become a chef. You can be a food scientist. You can look at how to make our foods healthier and more nutritious. You can look at packaging for longer shelf life. There's so many different components. And so anything we can do to train and encourage and inspire our future workforce is going to be critical.
Well, we get to work together between Ohio Farm Bureau and SIFT on a variety of fronts, the Signature Foods Program. And I noticed a guy named Adam Sharp, who's our CEO. He's here. He's what, sits on your board?
He does. So we're very happy to have him on. He's our newest board member. And that was primarily because we just feel that it's critical for us to continue to have the discussions on a broader space. So we've always been doing some things on the growing side and the production side. And my heart's in agriculture, my degree, and I'm still involved in agriculture and the production component. But I think a lot of times there's a disconnect. We're not necessarily all talking the same thing. We're not communicating what needs to be done. An initiative that we've been putting forth a lot of effort in is supply chain. How do we get more of what the growers are growing to the right people that are using it, even as an ingredient? So if it's not a fresh item, is there opportunities elsewhere? So really having the connection between Ohio Farm Bureau and SIFT and bringing those interactions, those discussions, those conversations to the table, I think is only going to do more and more positive things for our state.
So you mentioned that you work with some of the big names in the food industry, but you work with a lot of the mom and pops and young startups and such. Tell me a success story or two of something SIFT's been able to do that makes you feel real good.
Oh, gosh. I love our small business program. It's one of those things that the entrepreneur mind is an amazing one. They're passionate. They're dedicated. When it comes to food, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. They're creative. They want to see something come to fruition. We're fortunate we can guide them through that process. We have a facility they can make their product. And probably one of our signature successes out of that, Willie Salsa, he came with a recipe and quit his job, put his whole savings into this concept, which is not something I typically recommend and certainly don't encourage. But he was dedicated and determined to make this happen, and we worked with him for 10 years. He had an office at our facility. He made product at our facility that he was distributing to 26 states. Now he has launched into his own venue. He has his own mini factory. He is growing rapidly. We assisted him with not only that build out, but now also passing a third-party audit to the degree that is unheard of for a small business. He has taken that Cadillac approach on this is what I'm doing and this is how I'm going to do it, and anticipates probably being in every state in the nation by the end of this year or early next year, and I have no doubt that he will do that. So when you see someone who just comes in with simply a passion and a dedication and says, I'm going to make this happen, and we're along for the ride to try to guide him as best as we can, and then see it materialize, I think we always are kind of like, oh, okay, you know.
Maybe.
Everybody has a great product. Everybody has something that they've been encouraged to pursue. But to see that level of success has been particularly rewarding, and I'm only further encouraged by what he was able to do, and then hopefully we can see additional people follow suit.
Rebecca Singer, the CEO of the Center for Innovative Food Technology, the group that hosted the conference. Their keynote speaker was David Fetter. He's executive editor of Prepared Foods Magazine, the largest food manufacturing magazine in the United States. Now, in a time when lots of folks want their food as close to its natural state as possible, the idea that the food industry is just full of people like developers and manufacturers, doesn't that sound a little bit scary?
Well, it's interesting you ask about that. I started out in consumer journalism, so I was like you when I entered into this side of it. You know, who are these people? What do they do? And your eyes will open. This is a trillion-dollar industry, and it covers pretty much everything that we eat from farm to table. And nothing to be afraid of. Somebody has got to turn the spinach that's grown into the salads and the side dishes and the smoothies. Somebody's got to do all that, and that's the food industry. And another reason we shouldn't be afraid, I'm an old hippie, and we're running the program now. So the focus, all these big food manufacturers and beverage manufacturers, the focus is on creating wholesome, tasty, healthy, great products for people. And it's not as nefarious as maybe it was, you know, in the 50s and 60s, but, you know, whether it was or not. But it's really just a bunch of people who are interested in creating great food and beverage products.
So these products that I'm going to end up buying at the grocery store or order off the menu at the restaurant, I'm going to ask you the chicken or the egg question. When it comes to identifying what the consumer will buy, do you start with what the consumer's telling the food manufacturing industry, or do you think these things up and see if they sell?
That's an excellent question. I'll tell you why. When I was first coming up in the food business, and I've been in the food business for 45 years in some form or another. I started out life as a chef. There used to be a big gap of time. You would have a trend, and it would start by an upper-tier chef, either a five-star chef or a popular restaurant chef, and it would be, you know, the full-blown creative process. And that would slowly first trickle down to the QSR restaurants as it became popular, then fast food. And then the food product makers would pick it up. They'd say, oh, this is a really hot trend. It could be 18 months. It could be several years before it would get to the American refrigerator, grocery case, table, whatever. That has not only compressed, and I've watched this happen even since I started working in the business-to-business world, but it started to compress in time to where a great product that came out of a restaurant chef's creativity could end up hitting the shelves within 6 months, and then it compressed once again only recently where the food companies and ingredient companies went out and just hired up all the best chefs. So now you have real top-of-the-line creative chefs who are in the skunk works making these products to hit the shelves. And some of these chefs, they never see the inside of a restaurant anymore. And some of these guys are amazing, guys and gals. Amazing. Incredible creativity.
Town Hall, Ohio will continue right after this.
You are what you eat. You are what you eat. Whether it's fruit or meat or a sticky gooey treat, you are what you eat.
Back with us this week is David Fetter, executive editor of Prepared Foods Magazine. A few minutes ago, he was telling us about the process of developing new foods and how it has changed, now largely driven by food companies hiring top-notch chefs and then turning them loose to create products. I asked David about how those chefs and their employers communicate back to the farm about what products they need to come up with their new food creations.
Yeah, there is a lot of interplay, and I think we can thank a lot of the farm-to-table movements, the farmers' market movements. The farmers have been much more vocal in getting their interests and curiosities out to the people who are going to make the food. A great example of that is quinoa. Yes, quinoa had to come out of South America to you know, kind of gain traction, but there have been farmers who have been promoting quinoa, you know, saying, look, you know, we've got this great South American grain. Sometimes it takes a little effort, a little time, but, you know, you do have a lot more back and forth communication, and that's what we get with this information age technology.
So we have a food system. I think most of us in America agree we're pretty blessed in terms of being able to produce in different fashions for different tastes across the board. The items that you've mentioned today, whether it's a brand new specialty crop type food or the farm to table movement, that takes a specialized type of production as opposed to growing 5,000 acres of corn or soybeans. Are there enough farmers that are interested in filling the farm to table, the specialty crop, the hot new ingredient market? Are there enough people that are producing that you're able to maximize it?
I do think there's going to be enough, absolutely enough, and for multiple reasons. The biggest, though, is economy. What happens is when you get a farm, I'm going to grow purple barley. I'm going to grow black barley. And the return on that is so much higher. And I think it's going to drive a lot of just wonderful variety in the things we grow in the U.S.
In Farm Bureau, we found that some of the smaller niche specialty type crops are points of access for young and beginning farmers. It takes a lot of capital to raise large-scale commodity agriculture. Not that it's cheap to get into farming in any way, but you can probably get your foot in the door working with some of these specialty markets. For a young man or woman that's thinking along those lines, any advice on who they need to be talking to in the food industry so that they're growing for that market as opposed to growing something and hoping somebody will buy it?
You know, I don't think they have to do it that way. I think that they can, you know, of course, keep an eye on, like I said, information age, communicate, go out there, look, see what's interesting, check out some. Quinoa is not the last of the new grains. Millet, you know, there are so many grains out there, teff. They can be proactive. They can be they research-driven and find out who's like, but they can also come up with the next new thing. I would like to see a more proactive farmer when it comes to choosing what crops to grow. There are crops that can be grown places people didn't think of. About a dozen years ago, they started to grow olives in Texas. Texas has a lot of great places to grow olives. It has a very strong wine industry. A lot of people don't know that Texas vines saved the French wine industry back, I think, in the 1890s. You know, but that kind of, you know, look and see what you can grow that isn't, like you said, corn, soybeans, etc. It's I think it could become of good value. Micro farming is also, tier farming. I mean, we're going to see a lot of different kinds of farming. So, look at it. If you're a farmer, a second-generation farmer, a third-generation farmer, take a look. See what's on the cutting edge. And if you can get in on the ground floor of it, you know, do it.
David Fetter, executive editor, Prepared Foods Magazine, a keynote speaker at the Food Technology Conference, sponsored by the Center for Innovative Food Technology. We heard earlier that one of the things that the center does is to help food companies comply with food safety regulations. And a lot of those regulations fall under FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act. Stacy Vernon of the SIFT team talks with me a bit about helping food manufacturers be more proactive on food safety.
So for FSMA, a lot of it is preventative controls. Companies need to have a food safety plan. So some of that is new to companies, some of the smaller ones, so we can help people develop those food safety plans to meet FSMA requirements. You have to have what are called monitoring procedures, so that's what you do on a daily. So what are they monitoring? So yes, putting those paperwork, what checks and balances do you need to do and keep those on a daily, whether sometimes they might be daily or maybe it's quarterly, annually, what systems do they need to have in place?
Do you generally find that the attitude of the smaller businesses is that, man, I hate doing this, or, you know what, I recognize the need for this?
Kind of starts out with that, I don't want to do this, but once they learn the ropes and get into it, they see the importance and why they need to have it.
Any idea roughly how many companies you're working with in Ohio in this area?
We've touched hundreds, actually, with the FSMA training that we do. We do several, whether it's food fraud, food defense, that preventive controls training. So we have about 10 or 8 to 10 sessions a year, and there's usually about 20 to 30 individuals that come to each one. And then there's still several companies that we work more hands on deck developing those plans for them.
Town Hall Ohio continues after this. If you buy frozen foods at the grocery store, you probably know the name JTM. Their hoagie sandwiches, hamburgers, and many other frozen foods are sold both at retail and in food service. It's now an international company, but JTM began as a small family meat shop and today still includes the kids and grandkids of the founder. Joe Moss is one of those family business owners. He and I visited at the SIFT Food Technology Conference, where Joe was kind enough to give us a first-hand look at a part of the food business that we don't often see.
So at JTM, we are a food processing company, primarily meat process products. About 30% of our production is non-meat. But we have three processes at JTM. We do grind and form, where we grind meat and make ground meat and make hamburgers, pork sausage patties, steak hoagies, meatloaf slices, meatballs, you name it. So we have a grind and form operation. We have a kettle cooking operation. That's anything you can cook and then pump through a 4-inch pipe. Chili, taco filling, sloppy joe. We do pump large particulate products like beef stew, and we do pump very viscous products like macaroni and cheese, but still stuff that you can cook and then pump through a 4-inch pipe. And then the third thing that we do at JTM is surprising to many people that are familiar with JTM. They're surprised to know that we have a bakery at JTM, and we make hoagie buns, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 12-inch long hoagie buns.
So are the foods then that you market, are they all under the JTM brand, and are they, what, a mixture of fresh and frozen?
About 75 to 80% of the products we make are under the JTM brand name. We do have another brand for our bread items, the Vito's brand name. Besides that, 10% of the products that we make are private labeled for the customers that we are selling the products to. All the products that we sell are frozen, 100% are cooked, and 100% are frozen. We sell nothing raw, nothing refrigerated.
So I know enough about family businesses that you could spend an hour telling me what keeps you up at night. But in the food safety space, given what you do, what are the worries? What keeps you up at night?
Well, I have to tell you the scariest part for me is my primary market is the school lunch program throughout the country. We have customers in all 50 states where we are selling products to cafeterias, to grade school cafeterias, and having grade school kids eat our products on a regular basis. And so it's pretty scary that you're working in a space, not only you're not feeding people, you're feeding children on a regular basis. So that's clearly the focus, the main reason why we choose to go fully cooked, fully frozen. It certainly puts us from a food safety standpoint, puts us in a pretty secure space.
Obviously, you do everything you possibly can to assure that food safety. Give our listeners an idea what your food safety protocols would look like. Not every detail, but in broad strokes, what steps are you taking to make sure that those hamburger patties and hot hoagie buns are safe?
So we at JTM, food safety is a priority there. Quite frankly, the consumer groups always talk about, you know, the big bad meat food processing companies, and they don't understand, or we should all understand, that I'm a consumer. I have kids. I have grandkids, quite frankly. I have a 2-year-old granddaughter that's cute as could be, and I very much concern myself that you might get sick off of something that you would eat. So at JTM, number one criteria, nothing leaves JTM unless I would feed it to my granddaughter all day and night. So that's, you know, when you have that sort of a mindset and that sort of an approach, when in our grind and form operation, for example, we developed a unique and innovative cooking solution where we can cook products to a little higher temperature, well beyond the temperatures of 160, where most pathogens are killed, and we can go on to 170 and not have a negative impact on the products. Our kettle cook products, we can clearly safely heat them to higher temperatures as well and hold them at those higher temperatures. And then from there, we go to package them in a way that ensures that they won't get what is called post-pasteurized contamination, so we don't have that problem. And then going to frozen certainly eliminates growth of pathogens as well. So we take every step possible, and I feel very confident with everything that leaves JTM. So I actually do sleep quite well at night.
What are some of the technological changes that have helped you assure your products are safe when they leave the loading dock?
Technologies that have come along over the past so many years is the really more on the packaging side.
Give me an example of a packaging method that helps improve food safety.
So we heat our sauces to a temperature over 190, and that's been shown to be the temperature that renders the food very safe. We package it at that in a film that has EVOH in it, and that reduces or eliminates the oxygen permeability of the film itself to make sure that no oxygen can get into the food, the finished product. And of course, you know, oxygen is going to be required for any problems to develop. We've been able to take advantage of technology advances in refrigeration that allow us to cool our products faster. The faster you cool a product and get it frozen, the safer that it is.
Joe Moss joining us today on Town Hall, Ohio. Joe and his family own JTM. Today on Town Hall, Ohio, we're hearing from a few of the folks I met at the annual Food Technology Conference hosted by the Center for Innovative Food Technology. And when I looked at the conference agenda, I just had to visit with Tony Nyswander of APT Manufacturing Solutions and Dick Motley of FANUC America, because the title of their presentation was Robots and Cobots. Tony tells us a little bit about robots in the food manufacturing industry.
We do what's considered in the robot industry picking, packing, and palletizing. So we're picking food, we're packaging food, and we're palletizing the cases.
So that's the robot side. Dick, you've got to do two parts. What's a cobot, and then what do they do?
Okay, cobot is short for collaborative robot. The collaborative technology allows humans and robots to work together safely. You know, historically, robots always were segregated in a cage, and now there are multiple ways to allow more human-robot interaction or collaboration, and that's where the name cobot comes from.
Tell me what a typical interface between a robot and a human might look like.
The robot in some cases could be right next to the human, enabled by a technology we have that lets us put the robot in kind of a virtual cage. So the old steel cages of, you know, days gone by are not necessarily needed. We can have a more open environment, you know, depending on what the robot's doing. And I mentioned during the presentation, I have a colleague that jokes that kind of depends if the robot's putting pillows in a box or sharpening a Bowie knife. So so whether the robot's safe or not, the process also has to be safe. But then we can take that robot and have it interact with a human through a sensing field, such that when a human gets close, the robot can slow down. When it gets too close, the robot can stop. And then the benefit there is that when the human does leave the interaction, the robot's back to very high speed, high productivity operation. If that's not possible, if the robot just absolutely must be right next to the human and they truly have to be working constantly in collaboration, then we have another technology that greatly reduces the force that the robot can apply or will apply before it detects that it's collided with something like a human, and it'll shut itself down.
So how does this translate to the consumer? Everybody in the food business buys some of your gear. What happens to the price of food?
Well, we hope that goes down, and because of the process and the labor that's less in there. Now, let's talk a little bit about labor, though, because there's a myth out there that robots are taking away labor. Actually, there's a labor shortage. So robots are enhancing the manufacturing so that we can manufacture more here and import less.
So one of the problems we hear is that that new level of labor needs to be perhaps trained, educated differently than the guy that might have been doing the picking and packing for you.
When the big buzzword is minimum wage, normally we're above and beyond the minimum wage. So we're creating better jobs, and the jobs that the robots are taking are actually the jobs that nobody wants.
Tony Nyswander and Dick Motley of the Food Technology Conference talking about robots and cobots. From new technologies, we move to old concerns that will never go away. That is, how do we assure the safety of our food? Ohio State University food microbiologist Ahmad Yusuf led a discussion on that theme.
Yeah, it was talking about the challenges facing the safety of food in this day and age. One of these challenges is the use of conventional techniques to look for pathogens. These conventional techniques, they don't work anymore. So we have to be on the lookout for newer methods to detect these pathogens in food and discover if we end up with even pathogens we don't know about in the past.
You get the sense, as just the general consumer who reads the newspaper in the morning and watches television at night, that we're having more food safety challenges, that there are more outbreaks of a particular type of foodborne disease. Is that the accurate story?
Probably not. Our ability to find these diseases and link cases together has increased tremendously. So it is likely that we know more about foodborne diseases than we ever knew. The other issue is mass feeding that is happening in this day and age. Remember that we used to grow and eat what we grow. Now we have food grown somewhere on the West Coast, in South America, in China, and we consume it. We have very little control of what happened in the fields. So now the problems are larger from that perspective. However, we probably had many problems in the past that never been detected.
We'll be back with more Town Hall Ohio in a moment.
You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find you get what you need.
As consumers, we can be a little bit needy or picky, or to be honest, somewhat difficult. Especially difficult for the food manufacturers, who are trying to meet a wide variety of consumer demands, which at times are in conflict with one another. One of the speakers at the Ohio Food Industry Summit that was sponsored by the Center for Innovative Food Technology was Dr. Abby Snyder, a food safety specialist at Ohio State University.
They have a lot of different programs in place to help ensure food safety. They formulate the product and how they process it and package it from farm to fork, as they say. And so another aspect of what we talked about today was how to balance some of the trade-offs they have, since they have a lot of different consumer demands that they're trying to balance.
Explain what you mean, trade-offs there. Food safety, obviously one of them, but what might have to be coordinated or collaborated to match up with the food safety goal?
We talked specifically today about consumer interests in different aspects of production. So in terms of formulation, that could be reducing some preservatives like antimicrobials, but also sugar and salt. It could be minimally processed products, which is another consumer trend, but that processing is often in place to help control various food safety issues.
Along with Abby was Dr. Ahmad Yusuf, a food scientist at Ohio State, who offered a rather blunt assessment of how we view food safety.
The most difficult question that the consumer need to have an answer to is, there is no absolute safety exists. There are risks associated with everything, including consumption of food. There is nothing 100% risk-free. And this problem, also the tendency to think that the food industry has done everything they can to prevent the presence of pathogen in food, it is beyond any food industry. There are risks, and use common sense. If there is a fresh produce you picked in the market, it's a good idea that you wash this before you consume it, and wash it thoroughly, actually. Don't say that the food processor should have sterilized. Nobody sterilizes stuff unless it is in a can anyway. So most of the food in the market is likely to contain pathogens, not often. It happens, and it becomes a shared responsibility between consumers and the food industry.
Abby, I'll let you close here. Your thoughts on that degree of risk as opposed to zero risk. Should we be comfortable that not everything is perfect, but it's pretty good?
I mean, we should always try and do better, both as consumers and as a food industry, in terms of producing and preparing safe food. So obviously there's always room for improvement, even in a food supply like that in the United States. I think the idea that there are ways in which consumers can help protect their own food is important, but I also think it's good, as Dr. Yusuf was just saying, to acknowledge that products have different levels of risk, and that consumers have agency in determining their own level of risk aversion and what products they want to consume. Now, as manufacturers, there's also choices to make there, too, in deciding how secure you want to be or how much margin for error you want to allow yourself in terms of processing conditions and the type of formulation strategies that you employ. So there's a lot of, as you say, personal responsibility in food safety.
Doctors Abby Snyder and Ahmad Yusuf both work in food safety at Ohio State University. I'd like to thank them for their time, as well as our other guest today, Rebecca Singer of the Center for Innovative Food Technology, David Fetter, executive editor of Prepared Foods Magazine, Stacy Vernon of SIFT, Tony Nicewander of APT Manufacturing Solutions, Dick Motley of Fanuc America, and Joe Moss, co-owner of JTM Food Group. A couple of hours at the SIFT Industry Conference left me with a few takeaways. Once food leaves the farm, our access to it is largely the function of a complex food processing and manufacturing industry. The industry is extremely high-tech, and high-tech is not something to fear, but rather to be appreciated, especially as it relates to protecting us from foodborne illnesses. Thanks for joining us on Town Hall, Ohio.
Town Hall Ohio is a project of the Ohio Farm Bureau Federation and is brought to you with the support of Nationwide. Nationwide is on your side. Join us again next week for Town Hall Ohio.